everyone. Welcome to Grace, and welcome to the midweek point of our 90-day Read the Red and Pray for the Power campaign. Here at Grace Church, we started 2017 with a 90-day commitment to follow a Bible reading schedule that takes us through all the words of Jesus Christ, so all of the red stuff in our Bibles. And then we committed to a few things during this campaign. We committed to setting a natural goal. That's kind of like a New Year resolution, something that with a real focused effort of our will, we could accomplish. And then we also set a supernatural goal. I think some of us have probably found that our natural goals actually are supernatural goals. We're needing some help beyond us. But we did set some supernatural goals that there's no way we could accomplish these things unless God gets behind them and helps us. And then we also set as a church goal, we set a goal to pray for resolution regarding our church facility. We want some clarity on what's supposed to happen with us in terms of a location long term. This morning was so dark and damp when I woke up, and I was thinking about all of you who came to set up this space this morning. And, you know, while I was still drinking coffee, some of you were here rolling out tarps and setting up chairs. And thank you so much. We so appreciate it. But we're praying about... But we're praying about resolution for that. And I just want to encourage you today. We're pretty much at the midway point of these 90 days. There's 6 weeks left of this campaign. And if you've lost a little steam, it's okay. As we learned in the Super Bowl, games are not won in the first half. So as all of the state of New England would tell us today, or state of New England, all of the region of the New England states would tell us today, it's not over. And there's a chance to ramp up momentum and finish strong and see God do some incredible things in our lives. So with that, I want us to put a bow on our Overcomers series today. We've started this new year with a series on overcoming. And with any of these themes that we talk about in church, we could talk about them for months and months and months and months. And there's a lot more to be said about living life as the overcomers. But I want us to talk about a few different things before we're done with our 90-day push. And so we're gonna wrap this up today, and we're going to do so by going to the book of Mark chapter 12. So while you're turning to Mark 12, let me also say hello to Margie Jones. I heard a rumor that our famous pastor missionary from Kenya is here today. Is that true? Is that a lie? Can you wave at me? There you go. Welcome, Margie. Great to see you. Mark chapter 12. Have any of you ever been challenged by someone? Have any of you ever been tested? And I don't mean in an academic test-taking or quizzing kind of a way. And I don't even mean in the way of where we would say that our kids are testing our patience. Have you ever felt like someone has challenged you? You ever feel like someone has called you out a little bit? Maybe not in a belligerent way. Maybe they weren't being, you know, angry and uptight. They might have been super kind. They probably didn't throw down a literal gauntlet or, you know, roll up their sleeves and put up their dukes. What are dukes, by the way? I don't even know where that came from, but I think that's the right imagery. They might have been very kind. They might have been very polite and very courteous, but underneath the words, there was a little bit of an edge. Have you ever interacted with somebody and you just felt like, I think they're testing the waters here to maybe call me out for a confrontation? And you're just like, well, where's this coming from? What's coming at me here? I've heard of stories, scary stories, and some sad stories of people who wanted to discredit a celebrity or a high-profile person. So they hired a plant to try and entice that person and seduce that person. And then when that person gave into the temptation and fell for that, they exposed them and then they smeared them. Have you ever imagined what it would be like to live your life knowing that somebody was waiting out there to watch you mess up, to try and entice you, to try and take you on? Jesus Christ was tested all throughout his ministry. All throughout his ministry, Jesus was tested. The religious leaders of the day were always waiting for him to mess up. At first, they just watched him really closely. At first, they were just listening to him. Is he going to misquote the Old Testament? Is he going to do something awkward or wrong? And when he never did, then they took it a step farther and they got organized and they started sending plants into the crowd. And they would wait for a very vulnerable moment, like a Sabbath day, when a group of sick people had come up to him and were trying to have him touch them so they could be healed. And in that moment, one of these plants would say, teacher, is it lawful to heal somebody on the Sabbath day? And if he said yes, he would have been in violation of Moses' law, because Moses said to rest on the Sabbath. But then if he said no, he'd have to back up from the sick people and be like, oh, can't touch you, I'm resting. And so they were constantly coming up to him with these questions. They were constantly saying, teacher, Moses told us this or that, but what do you say about this or that? Everywhere he went, they were calling him out. In fact, that used to happen to Bruce Lee all the time. I don't know if you knew this. I was reading about Bruce Lee's life. Did you know that extras from the sets would challenge him to fight in between filming? He would be filming these staged fight scenes and he's beating all these guys up in the, he's beating them all up in the choreographed scenes. But then after the scene would end, guys would call him out. It was like the Wild Wild West. They would call him out on the set and they would fight him. He always won, by the way. But in Mark chapter 12, these religious leaders come to Jesus, and this is near the very end of his ministry. So all throughout his ministry, they've been testing him. And up to this point, they have never been able to trip him up. Jesus has been brilliant. He's been profound, and they've never been able to trip him up. So they come to him here and they want to do kind of a last ditch barrage of questions. They're going to flurry on him. In boxing, there's a term called a flurry, where in boxing, sometimes if a fighter has not done enough to decisively win the 3-minute round, they'll unload a flurry of punches in the last 10 seconds of the round. They'll just go crazy. They'll just start punching crazily. They're not actually trying to knock their opponent out. What they're trying to do is impress the judges. They're trying to send a message that I could unload anytime I want to, that I'm all over this guy and I'm really in charge. They're just trying to send a perception. In fact, Oscar De La Hoya used to do that all the time. But here in this passage, these religious leaders unleash a flurry. They unleash a wave of questions to try and trip him up. Here's what they ask him in Mark 12. One of the questions is, teacher, which is the greatest of all of the commandments in Scripture? And they ask that question because they assumed that they assume that whatever it is that they tell him, they're going to be able to undercut it somehow. They're going to be able to find an error in his thinking. And then they come up to him and they ask him this crazy marriage question. Teacher, Moses told us that if a woman's husband dies, his brother is supposed to marry her so that she'll be taken care of. But what would we do if that happened 7 times? What do we do if she marries 7 brothers and they all die? Whose wife will she be in the afterlife? I mean, this is the stuff they're trying to come up with to trip him up. They're really given a last-ditch effort. But here in Mark 12, at the beginning of the flurry, they ask Jesus a question that was supposed to be the knockout punch. This was supposed to be the question that would do him in. This was the diciest, most complex question that they ever asked Jesus in his ministry. In Mark 12:13, it says, later, they sent some of the Pharisees and the Herodians to Jesus to catch him in his words. They came to him and they said, teacher, we know that you are a man of integrity. So we'll start with a little bit of flattery, because that will certainly get Jesus' attention and win him over to our side. You aren't swayed by others because you pay no attention to who they are, but you teach the way of God in accordance with the truth. Is it right to pay the imperial tax to Caesar or not? Should we pay or shouldn't we? This is an interesting question. Now, taxation questions are often controversial. Political questions are almost always controversial. And so when you blend a taxation political question, you are stirring up a hotbed of potential controversy. By the way, We think that the political climate in our country today is tense. It was nothing compared to Israel in the first century when they were trying to hold on to their religious identity and their national identity while laboring under the rule and the influence of Rome. But this question was controversial. And what they were doing is they were setting Jesus up for a no-win response. See, as citizens of Rome, the Jewish people were taxed incredibly. They paid their own national taxes, and they paid their offerings to the temple the way Moses told them to do, and they had to pay some taxes to Rome. But this particular tax, the imperial tax, was the worst. This tax was a tax that was given annually, and it was only applied to conquered people. So Roman citizens did not have to pay this tax. This was a tax that affirmed the fact that I'm a conquered person, I'm a subject of Rome, and it was very controversial. There actually were some Jewish leaders who supported Rome. In fact, notice in verse 13 who it was that came to Jesus. In this verse, there's a group of Pharisees and Herodians who came to Jesus. Herodians were Jewish leaders who actually supported King Herod. King Herod, of course, was a representative of Rome. And even though he was a foreign ruler, they felt like, we get some benefits from this relationship. Let's not be too quick to rock the boat. The Pharisees, on the other hand, were strict nationalists, and they hated the Roman occupation. So what they did by coming together to Jesus and posing this question, they set him up for a no-win response. No matter what he said, he was going to infuriate one powerful group in appeasing the other group. If Jesus had said, no, do not pay the imperial tax, then the Pharisees would have loved it. And the people would have celebrated him like a folk hero. He would have been like Robin Hood, you know, sticking it to the system and sticking up for the little guy. Of course, the Herodians would have reported him to the Roman governor, who would have executed him for treason. If, on the other hand, he said, yes, I do think that we should submit and we should pay this tax, well, he would have stayed on Rome's good side. But then the people would have rejected him for being disloyal to the nation. So it's a no-win answer. Very tough question. And by the way, strict yes or no questions usually are. Sometimes people will want to engage with you in a religious conversation. And often people will try and get you to give a simple yes or no response to a very complicated, delicate issue. You ever been in a conversation with somebody and they're posing a question that's very vulnerable and very delicate? And it's very nuanced. And yet they'll want you to say, hey, just give me your bottom line. Is this okay or is it not okay? Is God okay with this or is he not? Is this right or is this wrong? Just give me your bottom line. We have to be very careful with that. Because if we give a simple yes or no answer to a complicated, nuanced situation, that answer is going to be very quickly judged and categorized. And I'm not saying that we don't give an answer. I'm not suggesting that we be evasive or cagey with delicate situations. But guys, there are times that some situations deserve a deeper treatment than what can be given with a simple yes, no. So even if you have a yes, no, and we need to have yes or no perspectives on things, we also need to realize that there's complexity and there's nuance and there's layers that need to be treated sensitively. Because when someone is asking you just give me your bottom line, yes or no, they're usually asking a deeper question. When somebody is asking that, they're usually asking, for better or for worse, a question about God. They're asking a question about God's character and God's disposition toward them. And they're maybe even asking questions about the character and the disposition of the church. So it's super important in these conversations that we discern the motivation of the questioner. The text goes on to say that Jesus knew their hypocrisy, and so he answered them accordingly. Now, if it had said that Jesus knew their sincerity, or Jesus knew their curiosity, or Jesus knew their naivety, he would have answered them that way. But in this situation, he understood their hypocrisy, and so he refused to let himself be boxed into a no-win, yes or no situation. He says, why are you trying to trap me? Bring me a denarius and let me look at it. So they brought the coin, and he asked them, whose image is this, and whose inscription? Caesar's, they replied. Then Jesus said to them, give back to Caesar what is Caesar's, and to God what is God's. And they were amazed at him. The word amazed means to be astonished or absolutely awestruck. And the structure of the verse lets us know that it wasn't just the crowd who was awestruck. So it wasn't just the listeners who were like, oh, Jesus, that was awesome. Wow, you just avoided that trap. You're amazing. No, the structure of the verse lets us know that the questioners, the ones who were trying to trap him, were amazed by his answer. But really, what was so amazing about that response? It was clever. It was a cool little maneuver to get out from under the no-win situation. I mean, he kind of just lets himself off the hook. He doesn't actually tell them to pay taxes. He's just like, well, let me see a coin. Oh, is that Caesar? Oh, is that Caesar's name on the coin? I mean, you write your name on your underwear before you go to camp. I mean, if it lets everybody know it's yours. So if Caesar's name is on this coin, give it back to Caesar. He's dismissive. He downplays the whole thing. And then he never really lets them know what he means when he says, and then give to God what is God's. And so it seems so simple that for these people to be awestruck by the answer, they must have understood something deeper than those simple words from Jesus. Jesus speaks 20 words in this interaction. It's about 105 characters. It's one tweet. You can go up to 140 characters in a tweet. In one tweet, Jesus preached a sermon that left his attackers awestruck. And in one tweet, Jesus preached a sermon that gives us the pivotal core answer on how to live an overcoming life. Whose image is on this coin? Oh, Caesar's? Okay, then give back to Caesar what is Caesar's. By the way, whose image is on you? Give back to God what is God's. You guys are asking me the wrong question. You're asking me if we should be paying taxes, and you're asking me about politics. That's not the question. The question is, are you Rome's? Or are you Israel's? Or are you God's? Whose image is on you? The overcoming life. And here's the message today, right now. This is the big idea for this whole series. The overcoming life is lived as an intentional expression of the image and the likeness of God. The overcoming life is lived as an intentional expression of the image and the likeness of God. You bear the image of God on you just as much as that quarter in your pocket bears the image of George Washington. Is that Washington on the quarter? Okay. Who's on the nickel? Jefferson, isn't the nickel the worst coin ever? It's like a mocking coin. Don't you hate nickels? You think you got four quarters and you're at the vending machine. Ooh, four quarters. Then you're like, what? It's like just big enough to make you think it's a quarter, but it's actually less than a dime. It's nickels are the worst. But when God was preparing creation, when God was getting things ready to receive man into the world, when he was preparing the place where he would relate with his children, kind of in the same way that parents prepare a nursery to receive their newborn, God spoke order into the chaos. All throughout the creation account, sorry guys, all throughout the creation account, God speaks into the unshaped, unformed parts of creation, and they come into alignment, and light appears, and he's getting things set. But when it came to creating mankind, he completely shifts gears. In Genesis 1:26, he speaks and says, let us make mankind in our image and in our likeness. And then in Genesis 2:7, he tells us how he does that. In Genesis 2:7, it says, then the Lord God formed a man. Formed is a pottery term. It's a term that's used for the molding and the pressing and the shaping and the pressure that creates something out of the clay. Then the Lord God formed a man from the dust of the ground, and he breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and the man became a living being. If you form something with your hands, it's one thing to speak into the atmosphere, but if you form something with your hands, what do you leave behind? What do forensic specialists always dust for at crime scenes? Yeah, fingerprints. I know who was here. I know who handled this object because they left their fingerprints all over it. God left his mark all over you. You know, for our iPhones, we used to use numbers for a lock code to access our phone. Now you can just use your fingerprint. The fingerprint is a better identifier than a signature. In fact, let me read you an excerpt from a book I wrote called Second in Command, Leaders, Strengthening Leaders Who Serve Leaders. I wrote a chapter called The Fingerprint of God. I'll just read you a couple of paragraphs. It says that creation was speechless that day. They watched in fascinated awe as their creator donned a potter's cloak. Although his glory was slightly veiled beneath the robe, he still overshadowed the splendor of Eden. The infant wonders of earth diminished around him as he took his seat beside the potter's wheel. Creation could look at him today. They could see the expression of his eyes. It was love. The wheel turned as he began to press and mold the clay. Dust and water merged as before their eyes, the most spectacular of beings took shape and likeness. He was like God, but sleeping. The smile in the Creator's eyes touched his lips as he bent over the lifeless being on the wheel and breathed his very nature into his soul. The man leapt to his feet and saw in his first experience of sight the beauty of his Maker. He leapt from the wheel into the outstretched arms of eternity. God and man, Creator and image bearer, Father and Son, turned and walked away from creation into the splendor of Eden. They were holding hands as they departed for the first of their many evening walks. And as their backsides came into the view of creation, all of heaven and earth gasped, for the man, in addition to carrying the breath of the Creator in his lungs, was marked with the very fingerprint of God. You are so much more than your personality. You are so much more than your Myers-Briggs handle. You are more than the strengths and the weaknesses of your Enneagram. You are more than your story. You're more than your history. You're more than your sexual orientation. You are an image bearer. You are a coin stamped with the imprint and the likeness of God. You aren't God. And this is where broken humanity gets into trouble. We become so enamored with the image. We become so enamored with the likeness that we begin to think that we're the original. You're not the original. But you are the closest replica of God that anything in creation could ever be. And if we really understood this, if we really understood what it means to carry and live out the image of God in us, it would launch us into an overcoming life. Understanding the image of God and living out of that image helps us overcome in many areas. I just want to mention three very quickly. Number one, the image of God helps you overcome your brokenness. The image of God in you is older than the brokenness that's in you. The brokenness in you has been with you for a very long time. In fact, the Bible tells us that we came into this world broken. David says in Psalm 51, I was born broken. He said, I've been sinful from birth. I was sinful from the time my mother conceived me. You were born into a broken home, even if your parents desperately loved each other and couldn't wait to have you. See, we humans are a broken race. We're a fallen race. And yet, please hear this today. The story doesn't begin with sin. The story doesn't begin with we're all a bunch of miserable sinners who need Jesus. The story includes that. The gospel includes the fact that our sin has estranged us from him, and we need someone to bridge the gap and bring us back to get together. Yes, We are the walking dead without him. And yet the gospel story does not begin with Genesis chapter 3 when Adam and Eve sinned. So much of church today starts with Genesis 3. That's not where the story begins. It's an essential part of the story, but the story began before Genesis 3 when there was image and when there was likeness and when there was relationship. At your core, you are not wretched sinner. When the New Testament talks about your nature, after your new birth, after opening your life to Jesus Christ, you're not wretched sinner, you're saint. At your core, you're a new creation. Now, yes, God made a way to deal with our brokenness, to deal with the fallenness, but Jesus sees you differently than you see yourself. This is why Jesus, he always seemed to relate with people differently than everyone else did. Jesus didn't see the same thing at the core of a person that everyone else saw. Lord, you're going to have dinner with tax collectors? Jesus was like, oh, is that what Matthew and Zacchaeus are? I saw disciples when I looked at them. Lord, you're going to let a prostitute wash your feet? Oh, she's a prostitute? I just saw an extravagant worshiper when I saw her. We start to heal when we realize that we are more than our failures. We're more than our weaknesses. We're more than our sins. Jesus calls us friends. In fact, Jesus calls us brothers and sisters. Can I read a verse to you from Romans 8:29? This is a verse that I really am having a hard time getting my head around. I'm just not there yet. Some of you are probably here. You're probably more advanced than me in this area. I know God as Savior. I know him emphatically as the one who gives second chances and wipes the slate clean and lets us start over again. And I'm growing significantly in my understanding of him as Father. But I just can't get my head around this verse yet. Romans 8:29 says that those whom God foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to the image of his Son, that he might be the firstborn among many brothers and sisters. We are the brothers and the sisters of Jesus Christ. I can't get my head around that yet. That just feels too familiar. It feels too much like family, which is his ultimate aim. But even though I can't get my head around it, I do imagine that when I am able to get my head around it, that understanding is probably going to heal another layer in my soul. The image of God helps you overcome your brokenness. It connects you to a deeper core that's even older than the broken core. That's number one. Number two, the image of God helps you overcome relational storms. See, when I know that God sees his image in me, when I know that he sees his likeness in me, I start looking for that in other people. So when I'm changed in how I know that he views me, it changes how I view others, even the people that are really miserable, even the people that I really can't stand. See, it's not just the awesome people who are made in the image of God. The ornery, miserable ones are too. They just might not be living out of that image as much as other people. And see, this is how Jesus was able to command us to love our enemies. Have you ever read that command in the Sermon on the Mount and just been like, love your enemies? Are you kidding me? I can't even love bad drivers on the freeway. How am I supposed to love an actual enemy? Well, first of all, you and I probably don't really have very many actual enemies. There might be one or two people that don't like you, and they've labeled you unfairly, and you really are the object of their hatred, and they view you as their enemy. That doesn't really happen all that often. For most of us, do you know what we have? We have people that we used to love who have hurt us. And now we're wounded. And now we're overwhelmed. And when we see that miserable person in the grocery store, we want to go the other direction. So there's usually something deeper than that enemy. There's actually something like damaged love that's there. But whether it's just damaged love or maybe it is an actual enemy, when we begin to see glimpses of the image of God in a person, when we begin to look for the likeness and, oh, there's a hint of the image there, it gives us a grace to relate with them. It gives us the grace to love them that we didn't have before. How do you view people? How do we view people? Do we view people as potential threats or potential friends? Do we view people as someone that will hurt us or someone who will love us and make us better? Can I get really vulnerable with you for just a second? Will you still love me if I do? Should we pinky swear in advance? I'm going to bare my soul for a second, and you're not going to relate with me any differently after this? All right. That wasn't a very robust response, so. All right, in conclusion, sometimes pastoring can be very painful. I love this church. I love you so, so much. But pastor relationships in a church can get really weird. They get really strange because you can have a very genuine level of love, a very genuine connection of friendships. But there are so many variables that can affect a relationship in the church. There's so many factors beyond our friendship that could make you decide to go to another congregation. And many of those variables are beyond my control. And the friendships that we form and the friendships that we nurture can be sweet and beautiful and wonderful, but the variables make it very risky. See, I don't have any control over whether or not the kids are nice or mean in the youth group, over whether or not they're nice or mean to your kids. I'm friends with some people outside of the church. And the people that I'm friends with outside of the church, those relationships have fewer variables. Our friendship isn't going to be affected by whether or not I said something stupid or not truly theological in a sermon. That's not going to affect whether or not they want to be my friend. When somebody leaves a church, it doesn't mean the love is over. It doesn't mean the friendship has to end, but the context changes. And all of our relationships are set in particular contexts. So the love can be just as real. The friendship can be just as real, but it changes things. And it can become a vulnerable thing to open your heart up to people who may or may not be with you in 6 months or a year. And so because of that, sometimes I get really nervous when you contact me. Sometimes I'll get an email from some of you and you'll be like, "Hey, Chris, we need to get together. We need to talk." And I think, do they have really good news to share with me? Did God just do a miracle in their life and they want to process and bring me into their joy? Or do they want to talk? Do they need my opinion on something? Or is there a problem? And recently, I feel like the Lord's been challenging me in that area. And I feel like he's been challenging me, don't look at people as sources of potential pain or rejection. And that's not exclusively how I view people. And that's not exclusively how I view you. I tell people all the time, Grace Church has healed my family. I feel like when we all connected all those years ago when my family moved here, that we all kind of healed together and grew up together. So you've been nothing but amazing. But I do feel like the Lord is saying, I don't want you to view people as potential pain. I want you to view people the way David viewed them in Psalm 16:3. Listen to this verse. This is an incredible verse. In Psalm 16:3, David is speaking of the people in the land, and he says, I say of the holy people who are in the land. So this is his description of the people in his kingdom. They are the noble ones in whom is all my delight. What a great way to view people. How do you view people? Potential jerk. Somebody who's going to, I probably can't rely on them. How do we view people? Do we view people as the holy ones in whom is all my and his delight? Oh my gosh, I do view you that way, but I want to view you that way even more. I want to view every person who crosses my path as a holy one. You treat holy things differently. You treat them with a different reverence. You're a miracle. You're alive. In a culture where you drive at 80 miles an hour in a metal box down the freeway, you're here today. The fact that you are here is not a minor miracle. You're here and you love God and you're trying to grow. We are miracles. We're amazing people. And I want to view people more and more that way. If we did, if we started viewing our relationships through the lens of image and likeness, when it's all said and done, we would have a lopsided number of relational victories compared to our relational breakdowns or defeats. Amen? So number one, the image of God helps you overcome your brokenness. Number two, the image of God helps you overcome your relational storms. And then number three, wrapping up, the image of God helps you overcome, period. The image of God helps you overcome in all areas. Let me go back to the very opening verse that we used when we started this series. Matthew 7:24. This was the verse Isaiah used when he kicked off the series. Jesus is speaking and he says, therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and puts them into practice. Let's say it a little bit differently. Everyone who orders their life around the overcomer, everyone who orders the direction and the passion and the energy of their life around Jesus Christ is like a wise man who built his house on the rock. The rain came down, the streams rose, and the winds blew and beat against that house, but it did not fall because it had its foundation on the rock. So, pop quiz time. How do you overcome a storm? Where's Isaiah? He'll know. Look to Jesus. There's one answer for every one of these questions. How do you overcome a storm? Look to Jesus. How do we overcome during ordinary time? Keep looking at Jesus. How do we overcome relational storms? Relate like Jesus. Follow Jesus. How do we heal the brokenness in our soul? We keep following Jesus. Jesus said this in 20 words. Dwight Schrute from The Office can say it in about 10 seconds. Let's listen to how Dwight would summarize this whole series on the overcomers.
What is the most inspiring thing I ever said to you?
Don't be an idiot. Changed my life. Whenever I'm about to do something, I think, would an idiot do that? And if they would, I do not do that thing.
One more time. It's so short. One more time.
What is the most inspiring thing I ever said to you?
Don't be an idiot. Changed my life.
Whenever I'm about to do something, I think, would an idiot do that? And if they would, I do not do that thing.
But doesn't that pretty much just say it all? How can I manifest the image and the likeness of God in this situation? Whether it's a stormy season, whether it's an ordinary season, whether it's a relational hurt, whether I'm dealing with my own brokenness, what would Jesus look like in this situation? What's an accurate reflection of the image and the likeness of God? How do I represent the imprint that's at the core of who I am in this situation? That's the answer. And if that became the answer day in and day out, week in, week out, over a lifetime, we will look back at some point in our lives and we would be amazed at how faithful he's been and how far he's brought us.